And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and it's my honor to welcome Ace Atkins back to the program today. Ace is a former journalist and current writer of fiction. He's published over 20 novels, including the Nick Travers series and the Quinn Colson series. The eighth book of the Colson series is The Sinners, and it will be available in mid-July 2018. But today we'll be talking about the seventh Spencer novel he has written for the Robert B. Parker estate. It's entitled Robert B. Parker's Old Black Magic, and it's published by G.P. Putnam's Sons. Now, Ace, we haven't talked to you about Spencer since 2014's Cheap Shot. What's been going on in his world since we spoke last about him?
Well, I guess a lot in Spencer's world. He came under the ire of an arsonist in Boston. They burned him out of his apartment. He's found new digs in a new neighborhood in Boston. He hasn't moved for 30 years. He's taken down a con artist that preyed on a woman that was one of Susan Silverman's patients. And now he's taken on a case involving a very famous art theft that happened in Boston 20 years ago.
He hadn't moved in 30 years. How did the fans react to a new neighborhood?
Well, you know, there's that question of, you know, the Spencer I write about is the modern Spencer. He is Spencer of 2018. He's, you know, this is not the same character from, you know, it is the same character, but it's not the same character. Things have changed. And I've, you know, really been tasked with modernizing that character. But I think the apartment, I think after the events, I did a book called Slow Burn. And after those events, there really was no question if he was going to be able to return back to his apartment. So, you know, I don't want to change too much of his world. I mean, fans come to that world expecting to come back to places that they know and people that they know. But at the same time, I want to kind of keep it modern. I want to keep it fresh. I want to make subtle changes. And so even though that is kind of a small move, you know, going from Back Bay, Boston into the Navy Yard, I thought it was a, you know, kind of a fun update. And I think the readers liked it.
Well, and also as someone who goes to Boston probably several times a year, but doesn't live there, you can see the changes when you go back. So how much has Boston changed in that 7 years?
Oh my gosh. You know, Boston has changed so much since Robert Parker's time. You know, neighborhoods that, you know, would have been dicey and rough, you know, are now filled with yoga studios and sushi bars. And, you know, the Tough Mean waterfront is now very expensive restaurants. And Bob wasn't even around when they completed the Big Dig, which was taking a lot of the really ugly overpasses that were covering the beautiful waterfront in Boston. Those things have now become underground tunnels, new restaurants, new people, you know, new roster for the Red Sox. Things stay the same. The world stays the same. But a lot of those neighborhoods have changed a great deal.
You talk about the Red Sox. We learned in this one that Spencer's probably not a big fan of the flat baseball cap.
I forgot that was in there. I forgot that. You know, I've had a hard time with a flat baseball cap. That really has thrown me as I go to, you know, get a baseball cap and I want a baseball cap. And a baseball cap, you got to learn how to curve it. But now the new baseball caps, you know, they're so high. They've got a really high crown on them. They got the fat, flat bill. And it just does not work for me. So I end up having to buy what I'd call retro baseball caps.
Last month, I went to go see University of Memphis play the University of Arkansas in college baseball.
Right.
And 8 out of the 9 guys on Memphis were wearing their pants up.
Yeah.
I was really happy to see that.
Yeah. No, it's styles change even in baseball, you know.
Now, at the very beginning of Old Black Magic, a man by the name of Locke is asking for some help. What is
sure.
he wanting?
You know, Locke is a character that I would say is somebody that would have been in Spencer's life for a very long time, but somebody we just didn't know because he was off screen or off the page. But he's an old investigator, somebody that Spencer has run into in other cases, other things that we didn't know about. And he's very ill. He's dying. And the last case that he wants cleared from his books is this famous art theft that happened 20 years ago. And it's really bothered, you know, the art community. It's bothered the people that are on the board, but art lovers. And it's really one of the great mysteries in Boston. And Locke hands over his case file to Spencer, and he says, see what you can do with this. And Spencer, being Spencer, doesn't take this mission lightly, and it's a personal mission as well, because he wants to do this for his friend.
And it's no secret that this is based loosely on the Gardner Museum.
No, absolutely. In fact, that's probably, as I go out on book tour, that's probably what I'm going to be talking most about, is talking about the Gardner theft, because it is so captivating and interesting, and it just drew me in completely when I started doing research. And I was very well aware of the Gardner heist that happened in the early 90s in Boston. But the more I read about it, the more that I learned about what had happened and who possibly could do it, who were the suspects, who was questioned, why didn't the FBI follow through with some of these leads, where did the artwork go, how come nobody, it's just, I mean, there have been people, writers, who have spent years and decades just fascinated with this story. And some people who do little else but trying to figure out what happened to these priceless pieces of art that included a very large, incredible Rembrandt called The Storm on the Sea of Galilee, and also a priceless Vermeer. which there aren't that many Vermeers at all. I mean, this is something that is irreplaceable. And I could see, you know, even for me, I knew that I had to get on with the book and I had to write it and I had other stories to tell. But I could see how somebody would spend years on this, you know, because I always felt like I was getting closer. I always felt like I was getting closer to learning more about what happened. And maybe one more interview, I could find something out.
And it's amazing of that time how little security there was over these priceless works. Because I remember it was just essentially a bunch of guys ran in and stole that Edvard Munch, The Scream, from the museum.
Yeah, museums want you, the patron, to feel a closeness to the art, and they want you to not have any separation. They don't want to have glass between you and the art. They want you to feel as if you could reach out and touch it, and you can in almost all those instances. It's really an honor system. I mean, it's the same thing with the Statue of David in Florence, where an insane person went in with a hammer and, you know, knocked the toes off of this thing.
But it'd be kind of harder to steal that. You can't
Steal it, but you sure as hell can crack it. And, you know, with these paintings, these 13 works of art that were stolen back in the early 90s in Boston, this was not a high-tech theft. This is not like something out of Entrapment with Catherine Zeta-Jones where somebody's jumping over laser beams. I mean, it was a pretty shoddy, rundown security alarm system. There were only two people that were looking at the, you know, walk in the museum at that night, both of them minimum wage earners that were there because they, you know, they felt it was a dead-end job. They were not professional security officers. They were subdued pretty quickly, tied up with duct tape, and left in the basement. And for hours, these three thieves had the room of the Gardner Museums, and they picked what they wanted, and then they got away with these 13 works of art.
Now, the thieves in Old Black Magic aren't quite as ambitious. The scale of the robbery is probably about half as big as the Gardner
heist. Yeah, it's funny, you know, for me, writing about the Gardner heist is, you know, it's just so big, and what they took, it was so shocking that it's almost hard to transfer that into fiction. If anything, I lessened the degree of what was taken out of this particular museum. It really boiled down to, in my book, one work of art that was a work of El Greco, which would have been extremely expensive and extremely valuable. However, not comparable to something like a Vermeer or this priceless Rembrandt as well. But to think about everything that was taken and really an immense amount of, you know, you really can't calculate the money. I mean, you're talking about priceless works of art. But yeah, I did take it down just a notch to make it a little bit more believable for the audience who may not be familiar with what actually happened.
Tell us about the gentleman in black.
You know, the gentleman in black, you know, there always has to be, you know, going back to, you know, we've talked in the past talking about my love of classic crime fiction and classic storytelling and great film and noir and that kind of thing. And, you know, it always has to be something haunting and something very striking. And, you know, I'm thinking of course, you know, going back to the Maltese Falcon and something that's, you know, a singular work of art that just really draws you in. And so I don't know how I really got onto El Greco, but I was just fascinated by some of the darker images. You know, he was almost like a early noir painter.
But they say he was a modern painter before his time.
He was a modern, you know, he ended up influencing Picasso and, you know, people with elongated necks and kind of this stretching of reality that influenced a lot of the modernists. They went back, and at the time, it wasn't until later that El Greco was really appreciated. So anyway, I thought he was fascinating, and I'd seen some works of art that could be something like, you know, there are works of art that could be something like The Gentleman in Black. I just like the feel of that, and I could almost see it looking at some of his other works. And so that became the centerpiece of this particular book.
Who was the nobleman the gentleman in black was supposed to be?
Don't ask. I would have to look at the book to you know, give you a horrible pronunciation of who he actually was.
I actually did some Googling, and there were several El Greco paintings of a gentleman that looks similar.
Oh, yeah.
And some people say that one of those was of Cervantes.
Could be, yes. You know, absolutely.
That they were familiar with each other back in the day.
Yeah, it's just a fascinating period. I mean, it's fascinating style of art and stuff that was changing from the time of the Italian masters. And, you know, there's something El Greco, you know, supposedly said, we don't really know, but that he had a meeting. He was this young, brash painter from Greece, and, you know, why he's El Greco. And he was in Italy and met with the Pope. He told the Pope, he looked at the Sistine Chapel, and he said, he asked what he thought about it. And he said, if you'd like, I could fix it for you. So it tells you a little bit about his ego.
And there's someone else that we meet with a lot of ego, and that's Topper Townsend, who's the chairman of the board of the Winthrop Museum.
Sure. What a jerk that guy is.
He probably thinks the Queen is a bit too common.
I think so. You know, Boston is certainly a town of a very deep class system. And there are people in the Back Bay community and people, you know, on Beacon Hill and these old, you know, Boston Brahmin families that are as far removed of the people of the neighborhoods of, you know, Southie or Dorchester that you can get, just completely different to see the world in a different way. But I was on the plane years ago, not that long, maybe a couple of years ago, with a guy who was Topper. And I sat near this guy and I just watched, I listened to the way that he was speaking to people. He was speaking to the flight attendants. He was also just very rude to fellow passengers. And he wielded this silver top cane as if it was his staff, as if he was a king. I thought, I can't say on the radio what I wanted to say he was, but you know, I got off the plane and I just started taking notes about his physical appearance and his dress and his mannerisms and the way he spoke. And it was just, he was so, one of the most arrogant people I've ever seen in my life. And I just said, he's got to be in the next Spencer book. And that's how he came about.
Now, could you give us an approximation of the Brahmin accent?
Yeah, you know, that's a difficult one. You know, I probably could do more of a kind of working class Boston accent than I could do the Brahmin accent. It's a tricky one. It's especially tricky for a Southerner to to wrap around.
Do you ever write in kind of a dialect for like the Southie accent?
Yeah, definitely. Being a former newspaper reporter, I really pride myself on listening to people and the way they talk and listening to their accents and listening to their cadences and their rhythms. And to me, that's so much of writing. I mean, that's so much of writing is being able to really listen to and transcribe the way people speak. And that's what I did for a long time as a newspaper reporter. I have to go to Boston when I start a new Spencer book just to retune my ear. It's so different from Southerners. It's so different because Boston people speak very directly and they'll tell you exactly what's on their mind and they'll tell you off in a second and they don't necessarily mean it in a rude way. And Southerners kind of talk around the point. They never kind of get to the point. They don't want to talk about unpleasant subjects. People in Boston often want to talk about nothing but unpleasant subjects. They were very direct. They want to tell you exactly where they stand. There's no Southerners who often tell you where to stand unless they've got a gun, you know, at their side. But I love it. You know, I love to listen to people talk and I love to just to eavesdrop and sometimes take notes and get those characters in my head. I mean, that's probably the most fun I have with writing.
But it seems so much that Spencer is talking to people.
Sure.
And they so often are got things to hide from him. So they are talking around this.
Sometimes talking. I mean, when it comes to hiding priceless paintings, some people are obviously less direct in that matter.
Some people may remember Large Marge from Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
That's the first.
But there's a Large Marge in this book, and she's not a truck driver.
No, no. She's a very, very, very unpleasant person, too. You know, somebody like Spencer, you know, either you appreciate his confidence and kind of his wry attitude towards life, or it drives you absolutely insane. And of course, it's much more fun to write about Spencer in the room with somebody like Topper or Large Marge, who find nothing funny. They're humorless people. They find his offhand sensibilities revolting. And what fun it is to get people like that in the room.
Well, there's also a lot of people in the crime world that aren't fond of Spencer's smart mouth either.
That's true for different reasons. Spencer can rub people the wrong way. Yeah, for sure. Bob always said that Spencer says exactly what you wish you had said to somebody you don't like 5 minutes later.
How long does it take you to come up with those lines sometimes? Do they come at you in the moment or do you have to keep whittling on them?
Sometimes keep whittling on them. Again, Spencer is the kind of person that comes up with that right comment at the right time. And we've all had those moments time and again that we've had a, you know, conflict with somebody. And we can think, God, I wish I had said that one thing. And of course, I have the luxury of leaving the typewriter and going to get a cup of coffee and come back and going, I know what I'd say. You know, and that's why Spencer is spot on.
You know what the French call that, right?
What is that?
Staircase wit.
Oh,
L'esprit d'escalier.
Oh, scary. I like that.
Of course, there are a few jokes about the movie Topper.
Sure.
You're talking about Topper Towns in there, too.
Yeah, a lot of I don't know how many 1930s film buffs are going to be reading this book, but maybe some people will know what the hell I'm talking about.
Well, just recently, I saw a movie called The Tales of Manhattan,
mm-hmm.
and Roland Young, who plays Topper, Topper in the movie, was in it playing a butler, and damn it, he was hilarious.
He was great. That's probably my favorite. So people ask me sometimes, they said, you know, God, you have all these movie references or mentions of old songs and Hoagy Carmichael or, you know, Frank Sinatra, or you mention screwball comedy of the 30s, and you know, why don't you update that? You know, if Spencer is a modern character, why would he? I said, God, you know, I'm 47, but I love that stuff, and I watch Turner Classic Movies, and you know, we all have Spotify, and I love that stuff. I grew up with that. I grew up watching those kind of films. I remember Topper used to be on, you know, television all the time on the UHF channels, and I used to watch. I think it was in public domain, and I used to watch it, but I love those movies.
If I could have a cable package with just TCM and ESPN, I think I'd be set.
I think I'd be fine with just TCM.
Now, he and Susan are still a couple.
Of course. Yeah. Now, that's when you would really, really get some letters from people. He's been committed to Susan, you know, from the second book. So I think, you know, that's something that's going to stay for a while.
But she coins a new term. Mascopath.
Yes. Yeah.
So tell us all about a mascopath.
Well, a buddy of mine that works in counseling and does that kind of stuff. And we were laughing. We were talking about kind of the image of the male hero and really the male hero in fiction and some of the traits that they embody. And some of those traits are found in Spencer, some of those things that he talks about being a man and that kind of thing. And it's akin to, I guess, being a psychopath, only you're exceptionally concerned with your manliness.
Now, did you coin that term or?
No, that was something I think that people in the mental health area, they're familiar with.
Also, Hawk is out of pocket in this book. Where
sure.
is he?
I think I have him down in South America. I needed to give Hawk a rest. I mean, Hawk is one of those characters that, you know, for me reading, and he wasn't in every Parker book. He wasn't in every Spencer novel. And it was one of those things you want him to feel like a special guest star. And when he comes out, you want to say, wow, Hawk is here. You know, Hawk is back. And if he's used too often and if he's around all the time, he loses kind of that specialness. He loses that edge. And in this particular book, the character Vinnie Morris has a much more spotlighted role in this book. And I didn't want anyone to overshadow that.
How far do Spencer and Vinnie go back?
Oh, boy. Back to some of the later Joe Braz books where he was the right-hand man, tough guy to Joe Braz, who Joe Braz to me, I don't know if this was Parker's intention, but always was a, you know, very Whitey Bulger kind of character, swagger and attitude and really the kingpin running Boston. And his right-hand man was Vinny. And then over the years, Vinny worked for other people. And then Vinny went kind of, you know, freelance, started working for himself. And so he and Spencer go back for a long, long time.
Braz, that sounds like a Yugoslavian name.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, you go fairly traditional in this book. You have mostly Italian mafia members going
sure.
around.
Sure. I think that Bob sometimes wanted to stay around, you know, not writing directly about some of the neighborhoods in Boston and wanted to kind of keep it a little bit broader. You know, he didn't talk extensively about, you know, some of the people in the Irish community or the, and so I tend to be a little bit more specific about who these characters are. I guess in some ways, I think what Bob was trying to do is not to regionalize it, that it would have a broader appeal. And for me, I wanted to make it very regional.
Well, tell us a little bit about the DeMarcos and the Morellis.
If you get into the history of the Boston crime world, I mean, it is riddled with, you know, Italian crime families. In addition to what you'd think about the Irish crews, the guys working those crews down in Southie or Dorchester and that kind of thing. And, you know, but there was the traditional Italian mob. Now, the traditional Italian mob, a lot of it was based out of Rhode Island, but they did have families that had their foothold there. But over the years, and again, we were talking about changing Boston. We're seeing how the neighborhoods are changing and the people changing. My understanding, talking to people that are in law enforcement, people who cover that kind of stuff, is that old Italian mob is really gone. And it is across America, you know, what we think about the Godfather or Goodfellas and kind of stuff, those newer generations don't have that same thing of that immigrant, you know, that protectiveness of the mob looking out for them. And that kind of has dissipated. And that's what those families like the DeMarcos and the Morellis, those are families that once were powerful families that now have aged out.
Reduced circumstances.
Sure.
They're on now. And also they're run by a generation of men who not only looked at their fathers, but also probably paid too much attention to The Godfather and other mob movies and draw inspiration from those.
Sure. Or people who just, you know, grew up in a certain set of circumstances. I mean, you're talking about somebody like character Jackie DeMarco. Jackie DeMarco in the Spencer novels now is really the new Joe Braz. He's the guy that kind of has his finger in all the different pies. And he's a tough guy and he's got this family connection back to the mob and that kind of stuff. But you're talking about a guy that's, you know, third or fourth generation American, and he's, you know, the old ways and the honor system are kind of lost on him.
And Jackie has no love for Spencer either.
No, he does not like Spencer.
You mentioned the Irish mob. We have Devin Murphy And he he is just a little piece of work, isn't he?
He is. Devin Murphy is kind of the trickster of the bunch, and the fact that you don't really kind of know, you know, whose side is he on. And we were talking about the direct nature of certain people and the criminals you can trust. And, you know, somebody like Vinnie Morris, you can take his word to the bank. And even people when, like Jackie DeMarco, this is, I'm going to kill you, Spencer, he really means it. Someone like Devin Murphy is kind of a guy who hedges his bets, plays his both sides, and you don't quite know what he's doing. But his job is an art thief, and that's what he's done. He's been a thief and a grifter his whole life.
But he had the best of all alibis when it came to the
robbery. He did. You know, we won't go down too far down that road, but yeah, he was suspected in the robbery, but you can't commit the robbery when at the time you're serving time in federal prison.
Now, this is a crime that happened almost 30 years prior, and the name Geno Fish comes up.
Sure. I think people like that payoff as far as the real serious Spencer readers. You know, if you've invested 25 years reading the Spencer series and somebody comes in and starts writing these books and there's no mention of the history and who these people were and what happened and what are the connections and that kind of thing, I think it'd be a little disappointing. You know, you want a little payoff for all the time and all the Spencer books that you've read. And Geno Fish was a kingpin. You know, he would have been working in Boston, you know, back in the 90s and early 2000s and was a major character in that world. And I wanted to kind of mention his connection because if anything happened in the art world, he was a fence and he would have had something to do with moving that art.
Now, you mentioned earlier about bringing Spencer into modernity. How do you balance that?
Man, that's tough. And it was something I really didn't contemplate too much when I first started doing this. I mean, I'm about to start pretty soon my eighth Spencer novel. I've been doing this, you know, coming up on almost 10 years. You know, initially that wasn't my goal. I just wanted to keep going what Bob had been doing. I was tasked with writing the very next Spencer book not long after he had passed away. We knew the family wanted to continue this. The publisher hired me to do it. And so I just said, I'm going to write the next book that is in the what Bob was doing. And we weren't even sure if this was going to work. We weren't sure if the fans were going to like it. We weren't sure how people were going to react to it. We weren't sure how the critics were going to react to it. So it was a gamble. And I didn't really think beyond writing that one book. And that book was Lullaby. And I really thought of it as kind of this standalone Spencer in the way that Bob Parker had done, you know, that, well, he ended up doing two, but for, you know, finishing up that Raymond Chandler book. So I kind of wanted to give, you know, I wanted Spencer to go out on a high note. I wanted something, you know, that would have been that, which would have been the 40th Spencer novel. But thankfully it worked and the fans embraced it. They seemed thrilled that Spencer had not left with his creator. The critics liked it. And so we kept on. So now we're into almost 10 years after the fact. And the question is, who is Spencer now? You know, how old is he and where are we in time and all those kind of questions that sometimes, you know, I don't know how many people want to grapple with it, but occasionally I will get a crotchety reader who doesn't understand quite what I'm doing. So they'll say, how are you writing these books? What are you thinking? Spencer's 85 years old. You've got him running down suspects. He's going to break a hip. Well, obviously the Spencer that I write about is not of the same age and of that same timeline that Bob wrote about. And Bob even broke that timeline in his own time. Bob never wrote about an aging Spencer. He never did. Spencer was perpetually for, God, 20 years, somewhere in his early to mid-50s. And that's just how it happened. He never aged him. And I've kind of taken the pause button off Spencer and allowed him to age just a little bit. Not too much, but he's got, you know, he's got bad joints and he's been doing this for years. But things that, you know, would have happened in the 70s now probably happened in the 90s and things like that. But what happened, happened. And those relationships, whether with Vinnie Morris or Susan Silverman or Joe Braz or whatever, they all happened just in a different timeline than what Bob had written about.
Will you go on indefinitely until the family says so? Or is there any plan to?
I have just signed on for two new Spencer books, which I have not written a word of either of them. But I've just signed on to write two more books. I know what the next one is about. So I'm excited to do that. And then beyond that, we'll see. You know, I work for the Parker Estate. If they want to continue doing this, I am pleased to do it. I have lots of books of my own that I want to write. There's a lot of time crunch getting those two novels in, you know, writing about my own character, Quinn Colson, and writing my Southern novels and writing Spencer. It's turned into be a good thing, and I can do both of them. But hopefully, I'd like to continue this for some time.
Is the compartmentalization okay, or do they blend into each other sometimes?
Sometimes blend into each other, yeah. Yeah, which is, that's the trickiest thing. The thing I grapple with more than anything is the voice. And it's not the character or the story or whatever. It's switching off of the feel and the whole vibe of the Quinn Colson books and the very, very Southern, deep Southern feel of the books and the language and the point of view and just even my writing style and then having to put that on the shelf and stop that cold. And it's much more difficult writing a Spencer book because I'm not just writing a novel. I'm having to write a novel with the added thing of how would another writer be telling this story? So I had that other level of upon me saying, I'm not writing this book as Ace Atkins would write it. I'm writing it really as if Bob Parker is telling the story. And that's a hard task.
And the difference between going from first person to third person.
Sure, yeah. I mean, just little things like that and Southernisms and things that'll, you know, creep into the, you know, there's always a point where I'm writing where Quinn Colson sounds just like Spencer and I've got to go back and change it. And then there's parts where, you know, Spencer sounds just like Quinn Colson and I've got to go back and change that. And usually it takes me a few weeks to kind of get that transition.
Now, Spencer is still cooking up a storm. How do you determine his menus for everything that he's cooking?
One of the little in-jokes that I do have him doing is, if you notice in the books, the seven novels that I've written, he's pretty much always cooking Southern dishes. That's kind of a little in-joke that I have. And the other thing is that Bob, in the later books, always had Spencer drinking scotch. I've told you I like scotch fine, but I'm much more of a bourbon guy, much more of a Southerner. So, you know, I have him drinking bourbon. But usually most of what Spencer cooks is stuff that I cook myself.
Now, I will have to have one objection. He was cooking beef tenderloin.
Okay.
And it said 150 degrees in the middle.
Yeah.
And I went, what is he doing to that?
I thought it was too
That's almost well done.
Oh, too well done. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You need a tenderloin 130 degrees. That's all you want.
Well,
that's the perfect medium rare to rare.
It's so funny talking about cooking and beef. I was on another show earlier today, and we spent part of the show talking about how to make a perfect steak. So this is the theme of the day is cooking good meat. Maybe it's just subconscious. Maybe I just like my beef more well done.
Oh, goodness gracious. I wouldn't even cook pork that well done. 145 degrees tops for pork tenderloin.
Yeah, no, I like to burn it.
Now, you mentioned Quinn Colson, of course. When's the next Tippecanoe County book coming out, and what are they facing down there?
Well, it's funny. You know, we start off this book, you know, we're talking about high-end art theft, and we're talking about El Greco and Rembrandt, and we're talking about, you know, Vermeer and Tony art museums in Boston, the Brahmins, and that kind of thing. So when I finish this book, a new Quinn Colson book set in North Mississippi is about dirt track racing and trucking. And so I've gone really from going back and forth between two very different worlds. And this will be the eighth Quinn Colson, and it's called The Sinners. I'm very excited about it. It'll be out in July.
And so this is like backwoods dirt track, not like World of Outlaws or anything.
It's a step below World of Outlaws. I mean, these guys would love to race in World of Outlaws. They're not quite to that level yet, and I don't think they have the money yet to get fully invested in getting to race there, but they're working on it.
Also, Nick Travers has been brought back to life.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. New graphic novel that is based on my first book, came out 20 years ago, 1998, called Crossroad Blues. It's gotten the graphic novel treatment, and that just came out last week.
And so what do you think of the package?
It's great. It's wonderful. The artist is a guy named Marco Finnegan, and Marco does really beautiful kind of noir, black and white, charcoal-looking drawings. And he's captured New Orleans and the Mississippi Delta, despite the fact that he's never been to this area, just so well. And he really captured that character Nick Travers, is kind of a ragged, down and out, edgy character that I created years and years ago. I thought Marco, the way that he captured him was just spot on.
Thanks so much, Ace.
Thank you.
Ace Atkins is the author of Robert B. Parker's Old Black Magic, a Spencer novel, which is published by G.P. Putnam Sons. I'm Stephen Usery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.